I am Planta on the Line. This is the commentary.ca. I've long been a fan of Don Imus. Anytime I could sneak him into a conversation on this program, I would. I watched his show on MSNBC ever since we started getting the news channel here in Vancouver around 2001. He would be on live from 3 to 6 a.m. Vancouver time, and I would always record it and watch it later in the day. I had about 15 videotapes that I'd rotate daily to record the show. That way, if I wanted to go back and hear something funny or a particularly interesting interview with some politician, well-known broadcaster, or generally well-connected personality, I could go back a couple of weeks or more. It seemed everyone did the Imus show, and important politicians or journalists would go on there and goof off with the I-Man, while later on going on 60 Minutes, Meet the Press, or some other more highbrow program. I still have the 15 videotapes, and I've yet to bring myself to watch his last day or so on MSNBC. You might recall in April 2007, Imus had called members of the Rutgers women's basketball team some nappy-headed hoes. It ignited a firestorm that was at once unique as it was noteworthy. The Imus show quickly lost sponsors, and soon he was dropped by MSNBC, which simulcasts the radio program syndicated by CBS. The whole event started a debate over free speech, race, gender, and the power of language. Imus was off the air for a few months before re-emerging in December of 2007 on WABC Radio in New York and RFD-TV, and now, next month, on the Fox Business Network. My guest now, Michael Awkward, has written a thoughtful, endlessly educational, and fascinating book, Burying Don Imus, Anatomy of a Scapegoat. It's written from the singular perspective of a black intellectual who has a long-standing commitment to feminism and a deep familiarity and appreciation of the Imus in the Morning program. It illuminates much about unsolved race relations in America and more. Michael Awkward is the Gail A. Jones Collegiate Professor of Afro-American Literature and Culture at the University of Michigan. This is, I believe, his fifth book, and it's published by University of Minnesota Press. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Planta on the Line program Michael Awkward. Good morning, Professor Awkward.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. When did it dawn on you to write this book and to look at these obviously necessary issues?
I started thinking about writing it very soon after the controversy started. I was not at that time able to watch a show a whole lot. I'm not sure if I had cable anymore, and so I couldn't actually see the show. But I was following very, very closely the controversy in the newspaper and in the American news television stations. And the moment in which it seemed to me that I had to start writing about it was the moment that I discovered that virtually everybody I knew assumed that what he had said was a function of some innate and deep racial animus and a deep and innate anti-female animus, which I didn't myself believe because I, like you, had spent a good deal of my time watching and paying attention to his show, and it seemed that I had something to add to the conversation that maybe not a whole lot of other people could add to it. So very soon after the controversy started, it seemed that I could start writing about it. And it happened at least in part because of the fact that I found myself getting angry. I was angry about the simplicity of people's perspectives on this controversy. I was angry about the assumptions that were being made by ill-informed people. And I think I was angry as much as anything else about the fact that people didn't know his show well enough to understand or to have a context in which to place what he had said and to think about what he had said. And so he became, for the United States, the scapegoat of the moment, or at the very least, he became the easily identifiable white racist of the moment. And I just thought that that didn't work very well in terms of the figure that I knew and what I understood about who he was and what I understood about his show.
Who was responsible for that simplicity that you talk about, that the argument against him, the arguments for his ouster, that they were based in the simplicity? Was that Al Sharpton? I mean, was that the media itself, do you think?
I think that we I mean, Al Sharpton doesn't really create any of these controversies. I think he basically responds to them. But there is a kind of narrative in the United States that sees certain kinds of racial or gendered or class or other kinds of moments of dissension and difference and difficulty as being ripe for a kind of seemingly thoughtful journalistic analysis that doesn't wind up being that, in that at least in large part they find themselves thinking about and talking about figures they know very little about and offering sometimes key words in terms of allowing us to understand who those figures are. In the case of Imus, it was the fact that he has been known as a quote-unquote shock jock, and that became the moniker that stuck to him in a kind of way, so that anything that followed from it was seen as being correct or accurate, or at the very least possible, because shock jocks are supposed to shock, they're supposed to say incendiary things. And because of the fact that he became a shock jock whose words were seen and taken as an expression of what he thought and felt and believed, as opposed to what I understood it to be, and that it's a part of a kind of ongoing commentary on a lot of the issues that he dealt with. Because of that fact, he was easily categorized, easily minimized, easily containable, and seen as a sign that the United States hadn't dealt sufficiently with its racial issues. So I think the media is at least in part responsible for it. I think that black, quote-unquote, political and social leaders are in part responsible for it. I think in large part Imus is also somewhat responsible for it, too, because I'm not sure that he responded to the controversy as well or as in as informed way as he might have. But I think that once the news started to spread of what he'd said, once the internet started working, once it became a topic of mainstream newscasts in the United States, I think that he was doomed.
Now, the book is obviously not a defense of what he said, and what he's said since is that it isn't defensible at all. Can you place in context what he, those words, nappy-headed hoes, why, I mean, I don't know how to put it to you, but it's obviously, I mean, can you say that, or should you say that? Should you use those words?
Can I say it, or could he say it?
Could he say it?
Well, I think that part of what, at least part of the stick, as far as I understand Imus, is that there's this sort of pretense of a continued knowledge of and engagement in a popular culture that he doesn't really seem to know that much about. He seems to be a very, very thoughtful political questioner and commentator. He seems to know a lot about the government. He seems to know a lot, or at least claim to know a lot, about the books that he has people talking about on his show. He reads newspapers and news magazines in the United States somewhat voraciously, from what I can tell, but he doesn't seem to know a whole lot about the culture. But there are certain kinds of moments and certain kinds of songs that he seems to pick up on and to run with for days and sometimes weeks. And they often involve both, I mean, country music obviously is his most beloved music, but they involve to some degree or another black American music and hip-hop music in particular. And it seems as though, at the very least, part of what he was doing here was claiming a kind of hipness, because he was repeating the sorts of formulations that are, I guess the best way to say it is, that are central to some of hip-hop music, having to do with the portrayal of women, the negative representations of women. And so I think that part of what he was doing was responding specifically to what those cultural formulations offer in terms of how to think about women. Whether or not he can say it is another question, but one of the things that I claim in the book, and I thought it and felt it as I was writing it. I still sort of think it, but I'm not sure I feel it quite as strongly as I did then. What my sense was that what he was doing was, as he does on a number of occasions, that he was mimicking or trying to embody some other character than himself. And part of my notion was that he wasn't speaking for himself and as himself. I think he was trying to speak for and as a member of a community, and I put it in the context specifically of as a black male who was under, say, the age of 25 or so, and trying to suggest how such a figure would respond to the sight of those women. Now, whether or not I'm right about that is another question. I try to make an argument to at least pose that as a possibility in the book.
One of the things we heard at the time when people were calling for his ouster was that there would be this discussion on race relations in America. For you, observing the coverage, it was on the cover of both national news magazines in your country, Newsweek and Time. It was the story on the evening news, and everyone seemed to be talking about it in that week or so. Was it an illuminating time, do you think?
I don't think so, and I don't think so in large part because the discussion, as those discussions always do, take a very, very limited form. One of the questions was, and I think one of the limitations of the conversation came about as a consequence of the fact that people wanted to see this as an incident in which an empowered person was talking about and speaking about an utterly disempowered group. In other words, they were trying to act like the last 50 years of race relations in the United States hadn't happened at all. And they weren't trying very successfully, in my estimation anyway, to think really, really seriously about what it meant for those women to be college students, what it meant for them to be engaged in the culture in the ways that they were, what it meant for them to be, at the very least in terms of their educational pursuits, middle-class women. There was this sense in which he had too much power, they had no power at all, and things like questions having to do with sports and the place of sports in the United States, especially college sports, the place of women in sports, the place of sports as a kind of cultural phenomena in the United States and obviously in Canada and elsewhere, those weren't questions that people were really engaging a whole lot. But more than anything else, I think that we wanted the narrative to be something that we could contain. The narrative was one of a racist white man saying racist things about women who he thought of as being unattractive because of the fact that they were black. And it just seemed to me that in all sorts of ways that those formulations don't work and didn't work and didn't really get to the root of the problem at all, which I see as a sort of larger question. At least I talk about it as a larger question having to do with the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow in the United States and the degree to which the nation has even recognized those phenomena as important factors in the behavior of blacks in the inner city and the attitudes of whites concerning blacks in the inner city and elsewhere in the United States. So I think that it was useful for us to have pretended to begin a conversation, but we've had this conversation starting in the United States since at least Bill Clinton in the 1990s, and we have it every time some sort of incendiary event occurs where whites are seen as negatively impacting the lives of black people. But the conversation never gets anywhere because we don't want to think about it in terms of the larger historical implications of those conversations.
And why not?
I think that we haven't done a very good job of, unlike other countries where the evil that has been done to people has been recognized and acknowledged and accounted for and to some degree or another reconciled with. And we just haven't done a good job of doing that with regard to our the nation's relationships to black people. And I think because of the fact that we see ourselves in the United States as being this model democracy, as being the beacon of light for every other country in the world, including Canada, my sense is that we haven't done a very good job of thinking very seriously about the times when we do what other people, we accuse other people of doing that all the time, and that is not respecting the rights of people, not respecting the humanity of other people. And because there was such a dissonance between the founding notions of the United States having to do with liberty and equality and democracy, and the fact that we could have participated in the institution of slavery, because we can't figure out how, to some degree or another, we could have ever done that. I think a lot of us, or certainly a lot of people in the United States who aren't black, don't really want to engage the topic now. We sort of want it to go away. We hope it'll go away. We hope by evading it and avoiding it, we won't actually have to confront it. And I think that until we actually confront it in certain kinds of respects, it's never going to go away. And these kinds of incidents will keep occurring over and over and over again. And they do, and they have, and I suspect that they will continue.
I suppose people thought that with the election of Barack Obama, a lot of these things would go away. It obviously hasn't.
I think they wanted them to go away. I think that there was this desire to believe that they could go away. And as obviously anybody in your country who follows what's going on in my country knows, a lot of these tensions, a lot of these issues have now, despite Obama's impressive qualities in all sorts of ways, attached themselves to him to the extent that he's been viewed in terms of all sorts of racial stereotypes that the country pretends as though we've moved beyond, but we know to some degree we haven't. So, no, I mean, I do believe that a lot of liberals in the United States, a lot of progressives in the United States, want to believe that this election matters in terms of changing the dynamic of race relations in the United States. And I just don't, as much as I want to, as much to believe that, as much as the naive part of me wants to believe that that is the case and that could be the case, just too many things that have happened during and since his election suggest to me otherwise.
Yeah, but thinking of two things, Henry Louis Gates and his arrest, and the recent comments in the last week or so from former President Jimmy Carter.
Yep.
Over the criticism of health care, and that people who criticized Obama's health care plan were essentially racist. Can we talk about the impact of Imus's ouster? That when he finally left, he was fired by both MSNBC and CBS. The people that were calling for his ouster, did they view that as a victory? That they'd overcome something that was obviously a thorn in their side or something like that?
Yeah, I think they did in all sorts of ways. I remember hearing Jesse Jackson saying something very similar to that. I know Al Sharpton did. I know that the then president of the NAACP, Julian Bond, did. So there was a sense in which this was a victory, a sign of certain kinds of racial progress, a sign at the very least that corporate America would recognize the unacceptability of certain kind of comments being made about black people in the public airways. I don't know, however, that his ouster remained central and important to any of those figures. And I do know that when he there was talk that he was going to come back on the radio about, as you said, about 5 or 6 months later. The person that people kept coming to ask about whether or not it was acceptable was Al Sharpton, who at that point had recognized or acknowledged or suggested that Imus's continual marginalization and unemployment wasn't a goal of his, that what he wanted was a sort of literal but also in certain kinds of ways a symbolic victory over what could be perceived of as the forces of white oppression, or at the very least a victory over a recognition that it was not acceptable to demean black people on the airwaves and get away with it. So, yeah, I do think that there was a sense that it was a victory. The question is whether or not it was a victory that meant anything at all to anybody.
And it seemed that IMUS recovered well. I recall on the 40th anniversary of the assassination of Dr. King, Jesse Jackson was a guest on the program. You said earlier, Professor Ackward, that IMUS didn't respond well at the time, as well as he should have. What should he have done? Should he not have gone on with Al Sharpton?
I think that there was no way in hell he should have gone on with Al Sharpton. I think the problem with that was to legitimize the sort of criticism of him that he didn't necessarily need to have legitimized. I think it also made the people for whom Al Sharpton is a kind of pariah unable to defend him at all. He legitimized Al Sharpton and his nonstop and sometimes useful and sometimes not efforts to participate in the political process and the social and the institutional process in the United States in ways that I just think his supporters would not be able to, weren't able to accept and weren't able to appreciate. I think I understand why he did it. I think he wanted to demonstrate that he wasn't afraid, of meeting his critics head on, that he wasn't afraid of going on the airways with a powerful and important and articulate spokesperson for black people. I think, however, the fact that he chose to go on the air with Al Sharpton at a time when he was being castigated and criticized in that sort of way was a huge mistake. But I also believe that there was no way he was gonna save his show anyway. I think that the forces had become too strong in arguing for his ouster. I think that as soon as Bigelow Tea and a variety of other sponsors decided that they didn't want to support him anymore, that his jobs with ABC and with MSNBC were not only in peril, I think that they were over. I will say that one of the more suggestive and useful things for me, at least in terms of confirming my notions of who Don Imus was the fact that despite his losing of his job, that he still met with the women who played for Rutgers basketball team. He still talked with them and apologized to them face-to-face, and that he took responsibility for what he saw. I believe he thinks not so much merely as his fault, but what he saw as something that hurt them or could have been said to hurt them grievously. And the personal nature of his gesture, the sort of courage of that gesture, and the sense that I had of the sincerity of his gesture meant a lot to me, and just in terms of confirming the sense of the person that I thought I knew him to be, at least from watching him on television, despite the nature of his comedy at some points.
And from all accounts, it was an emotional meeting, and they did accept his apology. Did you think that they were used in any way, that the media perhaps painted them unfairly as victims? I mean, they were obviously hurt by it, but I seem to think, looking back in retrospect, that they sort of got swept up in this, perhaps even though they didn't want to be.
Yeah, my sense was that they probably didn't want to be connected to it much at all, but I think that once the media machine started working the ways that it was working, it was almost inevitable that they were going to have to comment and comment specifically about the nature of their hurt and their harm. And I do believe that they were, in certain kinds of ways, hurt and harmed, but the hurt and harm wasn't merely, or maybe even wasn't primarily, a function of the fact that Imus said something at a point in his show or at some point in the show, I think it was the ways in which and the extent to which it became a national and international, obviously, news story, so that it wasn't merely that Imus said something that they could have heard in a number of different venues, although not necessarily directed at them. It's that the media kept playing his comments over and over and over again and insisting that those comments were to be understood not as part of a kind of comedic response to something that Imus claimed to have seen on television, but as the expression of the sincerity of a powerful figure's views of them as human beings, or at the very least, comment on the nature of their appearance. And not merely on their appearance, on certain specific alleged qualities that they had. So I think that clearly Imus, in retrospect, wishes he never had said it. He probably believes he shouldn't have said it, and I think a lot of me understands why he would believe that. But what doesn't seem to be the case, and what doesn't seem to have happened as a consequence of it, is that the media doesn't seem to understand that it is the force that disseminated this information. It was the media in the United States and elsewhere that made this a huge story. And it was a huge story because Imus was in some ways both so powerful because of his cultural and institutional position, but he was also so vulnerable in that he could be made to stand in for and to represent an aspect of white American culture that we want to exterminate and exercise as much as possible.
Have you been listening to the new show, the show on ABC?
It is not easily available to me anymore. I've heard it a couple of times, including at a point when one of his guests, Deborah Dickerson, mentioned my book before the book actually came out. So I heard about it, and I've listened to it maybe three or four times on the Internet. But since it's not available to me, except if I sit in my office in front of my computer, I just don't have the time I used to have to watch it. So one of the outcomes of the ending of his show, at least as an MSNBC broadcast, is that I haven't been able to watch it a whole lot.
Do you think, though, from what you've heard in news reports and the sort, that he has advanced the conversation on race in America with guests like Professor Dickerson, Dick Gregory, and the cast members that he has that are black?
I know he's trying to. I know, however, also that there are ways in which nothing he says now is ever going to be taken as seriously about these comments, about this situation, as the negative comments that he made, at least in a lot of people's estimation, about the members of the Rutgers women's basketball team. I think that, at the very least in the United States, the only time when he gets mentioned, to my knowledge, is in response to things that now can be said to fit into this narrative of him as a controversial racial and gendered hater. And so he may, for his listeners, be providing a significant sort of service. I think that, you know, listening to Deborah Dickerson, for example, and knowing it's what I know about Dick Gregory, I know that they bring to bear a kind of angle on race relations in the United States that wasn't a huge part of his show before that. But one of the benefits of Imus's show, as far as I could see, was that it not merely reached his audience that was listening or watching it, but it then became, on occasion, part of the conversation about certain kinds of important issues like autism and the treatment of Gulf War veterans. And I don't think that people are as willing at this point to allow him to have that sort of impact on the culture anymore. He has now been contained to some degree and seen as a kind of negative figure, to the extent that the controversy surrounding him keeps him from having a say in, or at least being part of the conversation about things like race. So I believe fully his sincerity in terms of trying to do it. I think that the people who get to listen to and watch his show are able to profit to some degree from the incorporation of issues of race into his show, but I don't think he's having anywhere near the cultural impact that he was able to have before that.
Professor Awkward, this has been a fascinating and informative conversation, as has the book. Congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate your time. You're very welcome. The book is called Burying Don Imus, Anatomy of a Scapegoat, University of Minnesota Press. Professor Michael Awkward, its author, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.